name. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. So as you can see, the topic today is the end of the age. And, you know, as far as I know, this is not an announcement of it. This is merely talking about it, okay? But that's all I know. It could be that we never finish this lesson. But that was not my thought when I prepared it. We're going to be talking about the end of the age. I've been doing a Bible in a year study, you know, read through the Bible in a year. I do that traditionally. That's kind of what I do. And so I just recently, and not too long ago, got to Matthew 24. And I thought, you know, this would be a good thing to teach to the church. Because, you know, we come from a lot of different backgrounds. And I'm sure that we have a lot of different ideas that we brought in with us that have probably never been fully straightened out. And what I hope to do, there's some uncertainties and some disputes and some mysteries in what I'm going to talk about today, and I'm not pretending to answer every question or to have everything figured out. But I do want to lay out for you the consistent story of what I believe this passage is talking about. How many of you were here when Steve Collier and I did a class on Revelation a few years ago? Quite a few of us. If you haven't heard that, or maybe even if you have, I'd recommend you go back and listen to that if you have any questions about this kind of thing, because we kind of laid out there for you our belief about the millennium, which is a big part of what this is all about. There's a lot of imaginations that have run wild with the idea of a millennium, which is really only talked about in the latter parts of Revelation. And sort of the bottom line of that class was that we believe that we are living in the metaphorical thousand-year reign right now, and then as you you know, basically quite a bit of what you read about in the book of Revelation are things that occurred during the Roman Empire, during the early days of the church. And so go back and listen to that. I think, you know, it's like, what, I forget how many classes, 13 or some number of classes like that. And there's some slides out there to help with that. But today we're talking about the discussion of that in the Gospels. You'll find it in Matthew 24, and that's where we'll spend a lot of our time tonight. But we'll also look at, you know, it's also recounted in Mark 13 and in Luke 21, and we'll sort of use those as sort of to illuminate each other as we go through it. But you know, to set the stage, we're going to go through Matthew 24. This is where, you know, Jesus has, you know, in chapter 23, he's laid out the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, the hypocrites, right? All those woes to that group of people, right? And then at the end of it, you know, he says, you know, I'll leave, you know, your house is left to you desolate. You won't see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And then it goes right into chapter 24. So this is kind of a continuation. It's just as he was leaving the temple. So that's what we're talking about. That's the time frame, kind of the context of what we're going to be talking about. It's commonly believed that this was about April the 1st, A.D. 33. Now, that's a pretty specific date, right? So as you might guess, there are other dates that people might propose. And it's, you know, it's not nearly as definite as that statement of that date implies, but it's a pretty reasonable possibility that that was the actual date. And we'll look at the rationale behind that in a few minutes. But it was in any case, it was 2 days after the triumphal entry. The Palm Sunday. Jesus comes into all those hosannas and the palm leaves, and he's riding on a colt, you know, and there's, you know, here comes the King of the Jews into Jerusalem. Okay, so that's a very, it turns out, a very significant moment in history, in time, in all time, where Jesus enters Jerusalem as the king. So he had just proclaimed those woes. So if we take a look at that real quickly, in chapter 23, the last three verses, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate, for I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Then it goes right into chapter 24. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came to him to call attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down. Luke 25 describes a little bit more about the conversation with the disciples. It says they were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones, with gifts dedicated to God. They thought this was magnificent, and they were just admiring the buildings. So here we have it's actually a model of what it probably, something some people think it looked like. I mean, we have some pretty good descriptions of it, but that's basically what they were looking at. You can kind of see the door at the bottom down there. You can kind of get a perspective of the size of it from the door, I think. But it's a pretty impressive building. Not even though it was not nearly as impressive as the first temple, which had been destroyed earlier, but it was still an impressive structure, and they were quite amazed by it. And that's what Jesus was saying was going to be destroyed, not one stone left upon another. So verse 3 going on says, as Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Of course, when he says, when will this happen, what's he talking about? All those stones being pulled down, right? When will the temple be destroyed? When will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Okay. In Luke, there's a little more texture given to that question. It says, teacher, they asked, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place? So there's several questions here, and they've kind of muddled two different things. Jesus didn't say anything about his second coming there. He said something about the destruction of the temple, right? And so they asked, they were kind of confused, and they were mixing up different concepts and different things. But the way I've got this sorted out, there were three basic questions. One of them is kind of a compound question. But he says, when will this happen? Okay, when will this temple be destroyed? Okay. The second one is, what will be the sign that these things are about to take place? Again, the signs for the destruction of the temple, right? And then what will be the signs of your coming and the end of the age, which they apparently thought was part of the same event. They were connected. So they were wanting to see the signs of Jesus' second coming and the end of the age. All right, so we're going to see how Jesus dealt with those three kind of related, kind of unrelated questions, right? Apparently, again, they thought that the destruction of the temple meant the second coming of Jesus, and he's going to spend part of his explanation telling why those are two different things, okay? So Matthew 24, starting in verse 4, here's Jesus' reply. Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. I mean, right out the bat, he says, be careful, don't be deceived. For many will come in my name, claiming, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you're not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of the birth pangs. So again, he's in the process of explaining when would the temple be destroyed, right? I mean, you hear people pull these parts out and say, okay, we see as if we're approaching the end times because something happened in the news, and they connect it to some of these things. Wars and rumors of wars must be the end times. Now, what he's talking about here is what was going to happen leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And we'll get a lot more evidence of that in a few minutes. Matthew 24, verse 9 says, then you, talking to the apostles, you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. So again, here he's talking about, he hadn't changed subjects yet. He's still talking about the destruction of the temple. And he's saying, you're going to be handed over and be persecuted. We know that happened to the apostles, right? Okay? Because of Jesus. And at that time, many will turn away from the faith. I mean, there was a point in time when people were being, Nero lit the pathways with burning crosses of Christians, right? I mean, they were being tortured. They had been persecuted, those who wouldn't recant their faith in Jesus. So we talked about that in the Revelation class. All these things are happening, and the Revelation class was talking about that same kind of events. So the false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Increase of wickedness, you know, I mean, you could, people kind of like to say, okay, it's more wicked now than it used to be. It was pretty wicked in the time of the Roman Empire, right? You know, you could make a case that it was more wicked then than it is now. But regardless, it's pretty wicked now, but I think he's talking about then. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved. Verse 14, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. Okay, so we think, oh, okay, that means that the church has to evangelize the world before the end comes. But Colossians 1:23 says, this is the gospel you've heard and has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and in which I, Paul, have become a servant. So the gospel being preached to the world was accomplished in the first century. And it needs to be accomplished again, don't get me wrong. But in terms of what Jesus is talking about here, what has to happen before the temple would be destroyed, the gospel had to be preached. Okay. So we're going to look at some evidence of all of that. But he said, so their question of what would be the sign that these things are about to take place. He's kind of given them some of those signs, right? He says there's going to be false prophets. We know, I just put down a few references here to document some things we know from the scriptures about those false prophets. 2 Corinthians 11:13 is an example for your study. Wars and rumors of wars. You know, you can just go to Google and Google for the wars, first century Roman wars, you know, and you'll see there were multiple of them, okay? And, there, you know, Rome was basically at war with people in various directions through that whole time. Famines and earthquakes, we know there was an earthquake when Jesus died, right? There's also earthquakes when, you know, they were in the Philippian jailer, right? There are famines. You know, Acts 11:28 talks about a famine. So we know we have evidence in the scriptures that these things were happening in that time frame. Increase of wickedness. I mean, Romans 1:18 talks about that, right? It was not talking like some future thing that might happen or would happen in the future. But there was, you know, increased wickedness. And the gospel being preached to the world, we looked at that a minute ago. So all these were fulfilled before AD 70, right? AD 70 is the date I'm talking about because historically we know that's when the Romans sacked and destroyed Jerusalem. So all these things happened before that. So Jesus continues on. So he's talked about now all these signs that would be fulfilled before the end, and he's talking about the end of Jerusalem, the end of the Roman, I mean, the end of the Jewish system of, you know, sacrifices, the destruction of the temple, basically everything that they had lived for, known, and taken their pride and confidence in was going to be gone. It was the end. So, but here in verse 15, Jesus continues. He says, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. I'm going to come back and, you know, we'll dig into this thing on the abomination that causes desolation in just a minute. But I want to go back and talk about this one part. You know, Luke records this same thing, with a little different explanation. He says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, he says, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Here he says, when you see the abomination that causes desolation, let those who are in Judea flee for the mountains. So whatever that's talking about, it has something to do with armies surrounding Jerusalem, because it's this, you know, in the same parallel passage. So, but then, you know, he says, when you see that abomination that was talked about in Daniel, okay? So we have a picture here, which is some artist's attempt to describe the siege of Jerusalem. And a siege, you know, in a walled city was a horrible thing to experience. I'm not going to go into all the things that are said about what happened inside that city as people starved to death, as people, you know, looked outside and saw what was happening, and it was a horrible time. But this, you know, you can see up there kind of in the bottom right corner all the armies, you know, or an army looking out over the city. That was what that artist thought it would have looked like. So Jesus goes on and sort of describes what it's going to be like for the disciples and or the people inside the city. He says, how dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath, for then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. So, you know, again, an interesting thing. It talks about how horrible it's going to be, just kind of in broad strokes. It was going to be a horrible thing. But he says, you know, those days were cut short. And I want, you know, notice here he says, if they hadn't been cut short, no one would survive. But because they were cut short, some could survive, right? So we're not talking about the end of the world. We're talking about a horrible event that some people are going to survive, right? And he says, unequaled from the beginning of the world and never to be equaled again. So it sounds like there's time after it where there's going to be other events, but none are going to be quite that bad, right? So he's not talking about the end of the world. So y'all ever heard of a guy by the name of Josephus, a historian, ancient historian? He wrote, in the Wars of the Jews, he wrote a couple of quotes here from where he was describing what happened at the fall of Jerusalem. He says, if the miseries of all mankind from the creation were compared with those which the Jews then suffered, they would appear inferior. Nothing had happened like that before, nothing to that degree. And he says also, no other city ever suffered miseries, nor did any age from the beginning of the world ever breed a generation more fruitful in wickedness than this was. That it was, you know, it was a horrible, horrible thing. And this was a non-Christian historian reporting on what happened to Jerusalem in AD 70. So it was a horrible thing, and it matches what Jesus said about it, right? That it was going to be the worst thing. Okay. So let's talk about that. You know, he said, going back to verse 15, he says, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let's go look at Daniel. You know, he says, let the reader understand. How are you going to understand unless you go back there and understand Daniel, right? If you want to understand the abomination that causes desolation, Jesus mentions it. And, you know, Matthew recording this says, you need to understand this, right? So let's go see if we can understand this. Back in Daniel 9, we're going to look at a few verses here, starting in verse 24, Daniel 9, 24. And we're going to try to figure out what he's talking about. Daniel 9, 24 starts out like this. 70 sevens are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. It's quite a series of things that were going to be accomplished at that time frame, right? What does that sound like to you? Okay, sounds like Jesus, right? I mean, talking about atoning for wickedness, nobody but Jesus did that, right? Talks about putting an end to sin, about bringing everlasting righteousness. Okay, what we can have through the forgiveness of our sins in Jesus. To seal up vision and prophecy. Kind of sounds like there's going to be visions, there's going to be prophecy, but then in the end, you know, beyond this point, it's going to kind of be shut down. Right? And he says to anoint the most holy. Okay, that sounds like Jesus to me. Okay, now, so he says 77s. Pretty much every commentary, even Jewish commentators, think that's talking about 70 periods of 7 years, 490 years. Okay, he says, so we're talking about a period of 490 years. We'll find out in a minute where that's going to start. But there's a period of 490 years for all these things to be accomplished. Okay, so let's see if we can find out what that's talking about. Starting in verse 25. Daniel 9, 25 says, know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. So pretty interesting here. He tells you when it's going to start, fairly specifically, especially if you know your Bible. It's very specific when it's going to start. And then he says it's going to be 7 and then 62 periods of 7. So 7 sevens, you know, I'll give you my take on it. That's approximately the length of time it took to rebuild Jerusalem and the temple. Okay? So 49 years, that's about how long it took. In fact, the Pharisees, when they were talking about Jesus, they said, Jesus, you destroy this temple, I'll rebuild it in 3 days. He said it took 46 years to build the temple. So we're in the ballpark, all right? So that first seven, then you got 62 sevens after that. So he says it will be rebuilt with streets and a trench in that time frame. But he says that's the length of time between the edict and the time that the ruler comes to Jerusalem. Now, what would that be? What time frame would that be? There seems to be fairly broad consensus among Christian commentators that that's talking about Palm Sunday. That's talking about the time when Jesus rode on that donkey into the city, came in as the king. That he was, people were laying down those palm branches and Hosanna. You know, here comes their king riding on a colt. And, of course, Matthew 21 talks about that. It says, say to the daughter of Zion, see, your king comes to you gentle and riding on a donkey, on the colt, the foal of a donkey. So he was being announced to the city. And people at that point in time seemed to get it. You know, here comes the king, palm branches, Hosanna. You know, it didn't take them long to, you know, go to the wayside. But that was what that was about. So we're talking about 77s and 62 sevens. Okay, that's not the whole 77s. That's 69 of the 70, right? Okay, but so hope I'm not losing you with the numbers here. You'll have the slides to go back and look at. But that's kind of what he's talking about. And we have this is the same passage we just read. I just moved it up to the top so we could look at some discussion of that. So we said, okay, when was the decree? When was the decree? Nehemiah 2, verses 1 through 8, tells us about it. And the best evidence I could find, or the best consensus of commentators of when it was, would have been 444 B.C. There's a little bit of fuzziness or flexibility with the beginning of that, simply because the Gentiles counted years starting from a different... Their year went, I don't remember what month to what month, but it's not the same as the Jewish year. Went from month to month. So there was an offset. So what they counted as a year, and so it could have been 444, could have been 445, you know, it's something in that, you know, one of those years. And that's 444 in our current modern counting of years, right? Now, 69 sevens, that's all but the last seven. It's the 62, the one set, first seven, and then the 62. That is 483 years. You can do the math or you can trust me on that. I think I got that one right. Okay. Now, here's where it gets a little bit, you know, there is a pretty broad consensus, too, among Christian commentators, that the years he's talking about here are 360 days long. And that's based on several passages. I won't go into the study of how they get to a 360-day year, but it basically boils down to a 30-day month. They're lunar years, okay? And, you know, the Jewish calendar, every so often, they have an adjustment more or less analogous to our leap year to correct for the fact that they knew that there's more than 360 days between seasons from the sun. But they were counting months from the moon. So at any rate, 360 days for a biblical year, if those are 483 biblical years, that's 476 of our years, solar years. So I'm just giving you the numbers. I hope, again, I'm not glazing your eyes over with the numbers. Our calendar has no year zero. It went from 1 BC to 1 AD with no zero in between. Okay? And based on that, if you took 476 years after 444 BC, you land at 33 AD. Okay? Which is where we want to land, I think. Not only that, you land in April. Or possibly late March. It was when this edict was issued, according to Nehemiah 2, It was issued in the month of Nisan, which is the first month of the Jewish calendar. That month began at the spring equinox, which we all know is what, March 23rd or something like that? So the first month, starting March 23rd, extends into April. So sometime in that month, the edict was put out. So that number of months later, that number of years times 12 months, times 360 days, however you do it, lands at, some commentators believe they can land exactly on the day of Palm Sunday. Okay, and I'll say take that with a grain of salt. There is some flexibility or some, let's just say, some fuzziness in the numbers and the dates. There's been errors in calendars that you try to account for in all of this. And maybe you've accounted for it right. But the point is, there's some mysteries in there. But it points to Jesus and it points to the destruction of Jerusalem. So Daniel 9, verse 26 says, after the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, and the desolations have been decreed. He will confirm the covenant with many for 1 7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to the sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, in the NIV, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. For your edification and consideration, I also included the ESV, English Standard Version, of that last verse, where basically illustrating the fact that the temple is not mentioned in the Hebrew. That was interpolated by somebody to try to make it make sense to them in their doctrinal system. Okay, but temple is not mentioned in that in the Hebrew. So the point here is that somehow there's 62 sevens, and then there's another seven. I can't remember if I said this to y'all or not. Maybe I'm repeating myself here. But that last week, some commentators believe, takes you up to the point of the stoning of Stephen. Because at the point of stoning of Stephen, suddenly the church was scattered from Jerusalem. They went out and they started going to the Gentiles. So, again, I can't tell you that's accurate or not, or that's correct or not. Seems to make sense with the rest of it to me. Okay? So, but the bottom line is there's many mysteries in Daniel 9. I start out telling you I'm not going to solve all of them. All right? But we can draw some conclusions from this. It points to Jesus entering Jerusalem, probably Palm Sunday, right? And the abomination that causes desolation pertains to the destruction of Jerusalem. You can see that in Luke when he talks about surrounded by armies. You can also see that because Jesus himself says that's what it's talking about, right? So when you get to Matthew 24, verse 15, he says, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So he's telling the Christians, the people, his followers, get out. When you start seeing those armies, don't hang around. And there's a good reason for that, right? It was going to be a horrible time, and he was giving the Christians a chance to get out, the people who listened to his voice. Okay. So verse 23, Matthew 24, verse 23. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. He's preparing them for something that's going to come. It's basically about, if it was AD 33, then we're talking 37 years later, right? 37 years later. So some people who are listening to him would have been there. So if anyone tells you, there he is, out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man. Where there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. So basically he's saying there's going to be some false prophets. They're going to come here because of the destruction. You know, they see Jerusalem under siege. They're going to come in here like vultures. I mean, the carcass is Jerusalem, right? The vultures are the false prophets, right? When you see the vulture's coming, and, you know, don't be following those false prophets. You know, I included a link here at the bottom of this slide of basically you can read in Josephus' War of the Jews what he had to say about the false prophets that were leading people out into the wilderness and things like that during this time, just before the destruction of Jerusalem. So it was actually, you know, again, this was fulfilled in that time frame. And the carcass is Jerusalem. It's going to be destroyed. It's dead. Vultures were the false Christs and prophets coming in to deceive. So we go on to verse 29, Matthew 24, 29. He says, immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations on the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels out with a loud trumpet call. They will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. So now, given what we've talked about up to this point, what is this talking about? Sounds like it's immediately later, immediately afterwards. And there's a couple of points of view that I found about that. You know, how does this fit? You know, immediately after, well, you know, the earth hadn't been destroyed, Jesus hadn't come back yet. What is this talking about? Some commentators believe when it talks to me, the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light. Basically, for thousands of years, or 1,500 years, however many years it was, the Jews had been following the Mosaic Law under the direction of the priests and the Levites. They had been, during certainly the latter part of that, they'd had the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin. They'd had all these, you know, religious leaders. Those are gone. After the destruction of Jerusalem, that's over. That's gone. They're not, you know, and, you know, the stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. Basically, the law is gone. They cannot perform the sacrifices. There's no temple. You cannot continue to carry out the Jewish law. And by the way, if you ever study in the Bible with a Jew, ask them, you know, how are your sins forgiven? Because there's no sacrifice. They can't fulfill the law. So obviously, you know, that took place because Jesus had provided the sacrifice. But it goes on, he says, so at that time, Son of Man will appear in the sky, Jesus at the right hand of God, you know, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Jesus, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. So he's reigning at the right hand of God. And you know, again, this is one of these explanations of this. And it goes on in verse 31. It says, he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call. They will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. And, you know, sort of the way that's thought of is that, you know, angels are messengers, right? It could be literally, you know, eternal beings called angels, or it could be churches, could be Christians, basically preaching the gospel to everybody. So we're out right now, by that understanding of this passage, we're out there right now doing what he says in verse 31, gathering the elect from all over the world. So that's a way of understanding this. I think another way, and maybe even I like it better than that, is the one that talks about this as the, it's more of a general time frame. It's a 1,000-year reign. You know, this is where all these things are happening, and it's metaphorical in some sense. I'm not sure I can pin a physical meaning to everything in the metaphor, and sometimes that's a mistake to try to do that. But the point here is that these are things that happen after the fall of Jerusalem. Okay, we've talked about that, so we can go to the next one. So, verse 32. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. That's what makes me the most confident that this couldn't possibly be talking about the end of time. This is talking about things that happened during that generation. And he says, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. They're true. What he said, this is the truth. You're going to hear other people say other things, but this is the truth. Jesus' words. But he's still, at that point, talking about these are the signs. You should be able to recognize the coming of the destruction of Jerusalem. You should be able to see it happening. You can anticipate it because I'm telling you the signs. All right. Now we're getting ready to find out. One more. In verse 36, he says, no one knows about the day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Remember, their first question was, when are these things going to happen? Here's where he answers that. He says, I don't know, which is kind of an amazing thing for the Son of God to say. But he said it, right? It's right there in red letters. Nobody knows the exact time. But so he gave them the signs so they would be able to anticipate it. Because he wanted them to get out of Jerusalem, right? Okay, so he gave them signs. He didn't give them a date or an hour. He told them the signs to look for, right? For the destruction of Jerusalem. Now we're going to look at his discussion of his return, and you'll find that he handles that much differently. Okay, starting in verse 37, it says, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken, the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. Okay? So, you see the difference? He didn't tell them signs to look for. He didn't give them the signs. He said, you're not going to know. It's going to be a surprise. It's unexpected. He didn't give them signs to anticipate the second coming. That's very different from what a lot of us may have heard in other places prior to coming here. Okay? Matthew 24:39, they knew nothing. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Verse 42, therefore keep watch because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. So, think about it. They were looking for signs for when he would come back. What would you do with it if you had signs, or especially if you knew when? So he's coming back, 2025. If you knew that, would that change something for you? For a lot of people, human nature would be, I'll make sure that in 2024 I get right with God. Right? That's not what he wants. That's not the way he's trying to get us to respond. He wants us to stay ready. So he doesn't give us signs. Is that right? Does that make sense? Okay. So we don't have signs telling us, the second coming is right around the corner. It's going to be unexpected. Okay. And remember, Jesus in this whole chapter is primarily for further explaining his first statement that this temple is going to be torn down. Right? And answering their questions about what are the signs, when's it going to happen. But then the stuff about the end of the age, he says, you're not going to get signs for that. It's going to be unexpected. Just, be ready. And then he goes on. We have a parable here, a couple of parables. It says, understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready. Because the Son of Man will come in an hour when you do not expect him. Again, emphasis. If you knew the date he was coming, you would get ready for that date. But then you would not be ready all the time. He's saying you're not going to know that. So be ready all the time. Be ready at any time. Okay. So therefore, and here we have a parable. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? Now, remember again, who's he talking to here? The 12, right? Or the 11, and this is the 12. This is still the 12. He's talking to the 12. He says, and so this is, think about you're one of those who's traveled around with him. He's trained them to go out and be his apostles. He says, who is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household? That's what he had done, right? To give them their food at the proper time. It will be good for the servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. Well, I think the most direct application of that is to the apostles. Certainly, he says, when he returns, it's talking about sometime well into the future, right? It's pretty much anybody he put in charge of teaching, feeding his servants, right? So that would include elders, preachers, you know, anybody who's got a responsibility to for the spiritual health of anybody else, right? You better be doing what you were called to do. I take that very seriously. You know, I hope that all of us have the role that, in that in some manner like that. Matthew 24, verse 48. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. Like, I haven't seen the signs yet, you know. And then he begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So, again, you know, if we knew when he was coming back, we'd end up like the wicked servant, most of us. I mean, that would be human nature. We would say, you know, why wear myself out now? I'll get ready just before he comes back. So, obviously, we don't know when we're going to die either. So that's another gotcha. But that's the point here. He says, you know, he's going to come when you don't expect him. So don't plan, that's not a good plan to be looking for signs. And, you know, you go on to, that was the end of chapter 24, but you go into chapter 25 and he talks about the parable of the virgins, right, and the oil. He talks about the parable of the talents. You know, did you bury your talent? Did you earn something with it? He talks about the sheep and the goats. Did you feed the, you know, if you did this for the least of these, you did it for me. If you did not do this for the least of these, you did not do it for me. So there's an accountability to everybody in the room. You know, if you were thinking, okay, the one in chapter 24 is mainly talking about church leaders. Well, it probably is, but the rest of these are talking about all of us, right? But we have some accountability. So what is the message? Why did Alan decide to talk about all this today? Well, I did want to kind of clarify, you know, some things that I haven't taught here, and I don't know that anybody's taught here in a long, long time, if ever. But beyond that, I want us to realize that we've got to be ready. You've got to be ready. We might not make it out the back doors here after I announce, you know, if I get to that point, you know, that we're done. You know, you might get home and, you know, the sky's open, you know. Yep. You might run into a Mack truck on your way home, yep. You know. I don't know what's going to happen. You don't either. Be ready. So what does it mean to be ready? I mean, I think you look through chapter 25, you know, for homework. We won't do that tonight. Go through chapter 25 and think about, what does this say about me? Am I ready? Am I doing the things that he calls for me to do? And so that's our class for tonight. Go home. Be ready. You are dismissed. Get your kids.